Minding Creative Minds is a comprehensive well-being and support program available 24/7. Specifically designed for the Irish creative sector, including professionals in the film and TV industry. Experience peace of mind, knowing that a skilled team of trained counsellors and psychotherapists are at your disposal. They provide medium-term intervention and expert guidance on managing day-to-day challenges that often lead to anxiety and stress. Discover the valuable assistance Minding Creative Minds offers by visiting mindingcreativeminds.ie today. Take the first step towards enhanced well-being in your creative journey in confidence.
Hello there, and welcome to this latest episode of our industry film and TV podcast, Film Network Ireland Rep Chat. I'm your host, Remy Michelle Clark. As always, we are excited to bring you exclusive interviews with some of Ireland's top filmmakers, actors, and industry insiders. If you enjoy our show, why not deep dive into our back catalogue of over 190 episodes for a varied and exciting look behind the scenes of what it's actually like to work in the film and TV industry across all departments on the island of Ireland. Rep Chat is available on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you find your audio content relating to film and TV. Today, we welcome a really special guest, the author and activist, Winnie M. Lee. Winnie began her career as a film producer before a shocking attack in a Belfast park changed her life and career trajectory forever. Winnie began to write about her harrowing experience, and that became her first novel, Dark Chapter, which was published in 2017 and won the Guardian's Not the Booker Prize in the same year. It was also nominated for the Edgar Award for Best First Novel and shortlisted for the Authors Club Best First Novel Award. It's been translated into 10 languages, and in a funny 360 moment, Winnie is currently adapting it for screen. Her second novel, Complicit, is a book that is focused heavily on the film industry, in particular around the hashtag MeToo movement. So film, writing, and real life experience is very much intertwined for Winnie, and that's why I felt she'd make a really interesting guest for Rap Chat. Not only an author and screenwriter, Winnie is an activist around the issues of sexual assault and consent through the arts and discussion. She is a co-founder of the Clear Lines Festival, which explores these issues through the arts, and her ongoing PhD research at the London School of Economics explores media engagement by rape survivors as a form of activism. Winnie has delivered over 150 public talks, including a TED Talk. I hope you join me in welcoming her today to Rap Chat, and I hope you really enjoy this slightly different Rap Chat episode. Why not consider becoming a supporter of Film Network Ireland on buymeacoffee.com/FNI and sign up to become a member so you can benefit from all sorts of little extra perks. Tickets for screenings, tickets to our meetups, discounts, and so much more. You'll find more about us on social media, on Facebook and Insta on @FilmNetworkIreland and @FNI_film on the Twitter machine. So now, sit back, relax, and let's get the camera rolling. This is the FNI Rap Chat podcast, and we're here to celebrate film and the people who make it possible. Hello, Winnie, and welcome to Rap Chat, Ireland's film industry podcast. It's lovely to have you here with us today.
Yeah, thank you. It's nice to be on your podcast.
For those of our listeners who might not be familiar with the type of work that you do, could you give us a brief overview of your career trajectory until this point?
Yeah, so it's been a very unusual career trajectory. Actually, quite a lot of it started in Ireland. You can hear I'm American, but I actually was studying at Cork as a George Mitchell scholar, doing my master's in English in 2000, 2001, and I'd always loved film, and I'd never really considered film as an industry that you could work in because it's quite mystified in a lot of ways. And so when I got to Cork, I realized that they had a film festival on. So I was like, oh, cool. So I volunteered for the Cork Film Festival in 2000 and 2001, which was my first kind of entry into a space where there were actual filmmakers. And make a long story short, I kind of kept in touch with some of the filmmakers I met, and then eventually, I met up with one of them in London, and she said she knew the producer who needed an assistant. So I started working for that assistant for that producer when I moved to London, and I worked with her for a good 6 years, and we made a number of feature films and short films, one of which got nominated for an Oscar. So that was all great, and then everything kind of ended in 2008 because I quite unexpectedly became a victim of a violent stranger rape. Which took place outside of the context of the film industry. So my whole kind of career ended in that way, because that's the impact of trauma like that. So I never actually worked in producing films after that. Eventually, I went back to producing. Well, I programmed for the Tribeca Film Festival in Qatar, and I kind of produced their year-round screening series. So it was more sort of Film Institute screening end of things. But I also kind of realized I really missed film. But by that point, I'd become quite involved as an activist working on issues of sexual violence and consent. So that led me to writing my books. So the first one of which is Dark Chapter, which is I guess a fictional retelling of my real life rape, and I've actually now adapted that into a screenplay, which is funded by Northern Ireland Screen. So that script is going out to producers. But my most recent book, Complicit, is actually set in the film industry, and it really looks at kind of issues of Me Too with a woman who worked for a Weinstein type producer, and I guess in some ways I wanted to. In some ways, address the sense of loss I had about no longer working in film, but I also wanted to kind of address these really contemporary and quite important issues of not just Me Too, but all sorts of gender and class inequality that exists in the film industry, because that's really kind of what I experienced in a lot of ways.
Okay. Your novels, Dark Chapter and Complicit, which you mentioned there, they're all written in a very immediate sort of visual style. And, you know, it's very much the style that lends itself to being adapted to film, which is probably why Dark Chapter is already being adapted for screen, as you mentioned. Would this style of writing be somewhat influenced by your background as a producer, do you think?
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say my background as a producer per se, but as somebody who worked in film, who's quite familiar with the language of film. I mean, it's difficult to say because I've don't know a world in which I haven't worked in film or been fascinated with it. But yeah, I mean, these days, when I think of telling a story, I automatically kind of think visually. Writing the screenplay has been a very different sort of experience because you're really, really confronted there with how do you tell a story in pictures and not words. But yeah, I guess for me, I'm always quite interested in building suspense in a scene in a way that maybe reflects the way we're used to seeing a story play out on the screen. So I guess, I mean, if you look at the ways, you know, novels were written 100 years ago, really, or before the advent of film, really, they were written in a very different way. And now, when we think about storytelling, we're also impacted by screen storytelling, that has a huge influence. So I think for me, I'm very, very aware of kind of screen for ways of story, you know, kind of visual and filmic ways of telling a story. So that probably impacts the way I would shape my novels, I suppose.
Yeah, and so Dark Chapter, as you mentioned, you're adapting it or you've finished adapting it for screen, or are you still in the
Yeah,
process?
I'd like to think I've done with the process at the
Okay,
moment.
you're
I mean,
done. No
I've
more
done quite a few
edits.
drafts. It
Okay, yeah.
hasn't, well, it hasn't gone out yet to filmmakers. So my producer was just kind of wanting to make sure we had it at a very good stage. So I think we've done three drafts at this point, and
Okay.
she's saying it's ready to go out to directors. So I think they're putting the whole package together, which is kind of a relief for me because I'm like, how many more drafts do you want me to do? So
Yeah.
anyway, you're saying.
Yeah, so what is the process of adaptation from novel to screenplay like?
Wow. I mean, I think it's really different for me because Dark Chapter is a novel, like, well, I mean, not novelization, it's a fictional, as a novel, it's a fictional reimagining of my real life experience. So I'm kind of working with like two levels of adaptation here. So now in writing the screenplay, I've adapted the novel, which is an adaptation of my real life experience. So I think that's probably quite different for most people who are adapting, you know, a screenplay from a novel. I mean, there are obviously a lot of novelists who have a go at adapting their own novels, and some do it quite successfully into screenplay, and others who are just like, whatever, this is not my, you know, screenwriting is not their language. It's a kind of a more unfamiliar form of storytelling for them. So I think, you know, for me, it was actually quite brutal an experience in a lot of ways, because you're taking like a 400 page novel and you have to turn it into like 110, 115 page screenplay. So there's a lot of stuff that gets cut out, and so much of it is about, you know, how do you tell this arc, or how do you convey this character in a single scene, right? You know, so whereas in a novel you'd have like, you know, maybe 20 pages to explore something, in a screenplay you have maybe like 2 pages of screenplay, right? So that is a level of compression which is can be quite painful, I think, for a storyteller that's used to the breadth of a novel. Obviously you don't have interior, I mean, you can have interior dialogue in a film if there's voiceover, but you don't want to rely on that too much. I didn't use any voiceover in the screenplay, so it's all the stuff that you would use in a novel in terms of, if it's a first person narration, the reader being able to get a glimpse, an actual direct glimpse of the character's point of view and thoughts. Like, you can't really have that in the same way in the screenplay. So that's very much about, okay, how do we convey somebody's character simply in like their emotions, the way they dress, you know, not in their in their movements and their actions, and the way they dress, and how their dialogue really kind of just sort of sits on top of their whole being, right? The dialogue has to almost be a stand-in. Even if they say like one line, that has to be a stand-in for everything, right? So in the ideal world, obviously, if it gets produced and actually made into a film, you have a good actor who's able to convey a lot in the actual performance. But as a screenplay, there needs to be enough in that one line of dialogue for a potential funder to read it and be like, oh yeah, okay, this is where the character is at that point in their life. So yeah, I think it's very much about just really distilling everything down into short bits of dialogue, even short descriptions. You know, for me, I guess what we call the stage direction of the screenplay is something where I would normally, as a novelist, try to write a lot of detail, and you just don't have that space, right? So you have to like pick out those very specific details. And I guess what was interesting for me was that because it's based on something that happened in my own life, there's a fair amount of stuff in the screenplay that actually isn't in the book, but actually is from my real life experience. So, yeah, because I just kind of felt, you know, there's stuff that happened to me in real life that didn't really quite work in terms of the book, but for whatever reason, I was able to kind of put that into the screenplay. But there's a lot of the screenplay where I've just conflated characters in the book and kind of made them into kind of three characters become one, or like what might seem like a montage in the novel ends up becoming like a single scene in the screenplay. So yeah, it's a quite brutal process in that sense, but then also kind of makes you much more economical as a storyteller.
And would you be able to share any of those details that might be coming into the screenplay that didn't make it into the novel? Like, are there any details that you're able to put into it that you couldn't, that didn't work on the page?
Yeah, and I think it kind of speaks to both the process of publishing a novel, which is also can be quite brutal for the writer, because obviously you're working with editors who want to really pare your work down. So there was something that happened to me in real life, which, so to kind of briefly describe it, I mean, I after the assault, right? So the assault happened in 2008. The legal side of it kind of wrapped up in early 2009, meaning I went over to Belfast for the trial against my perpetrator, absolutely dreading that scenario. In real life, he pleaded guilty the morning of the trial. So I was sitting in the courtroom and waiting for the jury to be selected, and the barristers came in and said, actually, he's agreed to plead guilty. So it was a very almost kind of anticlimactic, right? Because I'd sort of expected this sort of big showdown, I suppose, because, you know, we're used to seeing these kinds of showdowns and courtroom dramas, right? And then suddenly it didn't happen, right? So in some ways, in the novel, I wrote the trial, right? Because real life just wasn't going to offer that kind of narrative climax. So I wrote that entire courtroom scene in the novel. I imagined it, and that's kind of like the dramatic high point of the novel. But then obviously in real life, you know, that happens, the you know, he was sentenced, and I still had to carry on with recovering, right? So it was almost a little bit kind of even more depressing, because I thought, okay, I did everything I had to do as a victim, and he's in jail, and I still have to somehow figure out how to put my life together. And it was really, really difficult in that sense. One thing that happened was in 2011, so we're talking like 3 years after the assault. I got called back to Belfast, because so they flew me back, the Northern Irish government, to be assessed by psychologists so they could determine how much my life had been affected by this crime, and therefore then determine how much money to award me as a victim of a violent crime. This is very kind of bizarre bureaucratic process. But I mean, I did it, right? Because, you know, why not, right? They were covering costs. I certainly could have used the money, because I wasn't able to work for a long time. So that happened. But for me, also the thought of returning to Belfast, you know, as an American who mainly lived in London, returning to Belfast, which is a city I automatically associated and will always associate with my rape, was actually quite, you know, emotionally challenging, right? Because it was, I went there, the rape happened. I then had to go through the trial. I flew back for the sentencing. So Belfast automatically always has that association with my own rape. Went back, had this assessment, and it was fine, right? By this point, it was like 3 years after the assault had happened. So I might have thought I had would have put my life back together by then, but of course not. I mean, your trauma takes a really long time, and it takes a long time to recover from these things. So I was kind of confronted with the fact that, like, 3 years on, I'm still, this process is still dragging on in some ways, right? And I still have to deal with like the kind of the bureaucracy of being a victim. But one thing that happened was that the basically all everything I was wearing during the assault, I had to give over to the police as evidence, right? Because they had to look for DNA and all that sort of stuff. And that included my wristwatch, right? So I didn't have my wristwatch for like a number of years. And after the trial and after the entire, I mean, pretty much like, I think it was like a good 2.5, maybe a year and a half after the assault, I finally got all that stuff sent back to me in a box, right? So I opened the box up. By this point, you know, my perpetrator had been sentenced. I opened up the box, and it's all the clothes I had been wearing during the assault, in this kind of Ziploc bag, in all these different Ziploc bags. So and it still had like the dirt and everything caked on it, right? So it's quite confronting to see all this evidence kind of in a box that was being shipped back to me. But then my wristwatch had been sent back as well, and I was like, cool, like I can use my watch again. But in the meantime, the battery had stopped, right? So I was just kind of like, oh great, right? And I didn't do anything with it. I just kind of like put it to the side, and then I guess maybe I got a new watch. I'm not really sure what I did, but like time sort of like stood still for me anyway during that whole period of trying to recover. Anyway, 2011, I go back to Belfast, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna bring this wristwatch back with me, and I'm gonna stop in a jewelry shop and get the battery replaced, right? Because it was gonna be symbolic, et cetera, right? So that's exactly what happened. I went back to Belfast. I went to a jewelry shop. I'm like, could you put a battery here? Obviously, nobody knew the significance of the watch. So they, you know, they put in the battery, and like the watch started again, right? And just kind of a small moment, right? And so I was like, oh, but this is symbolic. The writer in me is thinking like, oh, this is symbolic, you know, the like life starts again, right? You know, I can start using the wristwatch again. And I did start using the wristwatch for after that. But I was like, oh, I want to put this somewhere into something that I'm writing. And I couldn't figure out how to put it in the novel, because it was just like too small a detail to be worth having a scene like that late in the novel. Because by that point, you know, well, among other things, the editor wanted me to just like end, she just wanted me to end the novel like after the trial, right? So it's kind of like, yeah, but like that's not reflective of the reality. You know, it's a very, very long process of recovery. So it was this constant battle with my book editor to try to include scenes of Vivian in the years after the trial to just show how difficult the path of recovery is. Anyway, so I wasn't able to ever put like that watch thing into the novel. But when it came to writing the screenplay, I'm like, okay, how can we, in a single scene, in just a few moments, like convey Vivian's process of recovery and like slowly getting her life back together. And I'm like, I'm going to use that watch thing. So I did, right? So that's, and it's probably, if it ever gets made into a film, it's probably just going to be like 10 seconds on screen, but it's symbolic enough and it's entirely visual. Like there's not even any dialogue in that scene for us to kind of know what it means in the context of Vivian and her character's journey. So.
Yeah, well, it's 10 powerful seconds, because even as you explain that whole process to me of receiving all of the items from the assault and going through them, you know, there's so much emotion that's involved in that. And then, you know, it absolutely is a symbolic and hugely important moment, both for your life personally and would work amazingly in a scene, of course, as well. So it's, you know, I'm sure when the film gets made, which it will, that that will be a really powerful pivotal moment in the film. But it's a spoiler already, so you know, just pretend you didn't hear that. Anyone listening,
we've also just spent like 10 minutes talking about a scene which is going to be 10 seconds in a film. But anyway,
When you were, you know, adapting Dark Chapter, did you feel like you were more of a writer or did that producer element come in from your past working in the film industry? Or did you enter into a completely different space?
I probably entered into a different space. I mean, I think, you know, producing was exciting, and I still miss the buzz of it. And I still obviously have like kind of producer skills, which helped me in a lot of different ways as an author. But I don't really miss the constant sense of feeling like I still feel like there's an endless to-do list, but with a producer, it's just like it's a 24-hour job. And it also wasn't really creative enough for me as a producer. I mean, so much of it is just like logistics and business and that kind of thing. So after a while, I realized I was really just kind of enabling somebody else's creative vision, i.e. the director. And a lot of that's in Complicit in terms of how Sarah, who's the main character, it starts off as the assistant to producer, and she wants to become a producer, but she also realizes she's essentially kind of like serving these asshole male directors, right? And kind of always being around creatives but not being allowed to be creative herself. So I think that was kind of my experience as a producer. Anyway, but that whole producing career ended quite dramatically. And then I think as a writer, I found it, you know, I mean, writing is the thing that probably comes the easiest to me, so that's kind of creative and also rewarding. And then so when it came to writing the screenplay, I mean, it was a relief to have a producer who kind of recognized, like, I suppose, the inherent value of the work and also just what I could contribute as a writer. So I'm kind of grateful to her that she gave me the opportunity to write the screenplay and then continued to back me and, you know, get the funding for that to happen. So I think I quite relish not having to necessarily think like a producer, but obviously, I also wasn't going to be writing like hugely expensive scenes, right? Because I was conscious of things like budget. Although Dark Chapter in particular, there's nothing like hugely expensive in it from a production point of view. So I quite liked being a writer, but also being a writer who had actually written the novel of that story already, because in some ways I was less precious about it as a screenwriter. Because I've already had the entire novel. So if somebody ever said to me, you know what, you know, the novel was my kind of definitive artistic statement on that story. Sorry, I just need some water. So they're not.
Are you all right? Bit of a cough.
Yeah, I just. Well, I've just kind of. Everybody in the house is ill. So. Okay, so the novel was kind of my definitive artistic statement on that story, so I wasn't as precious if the script editor said, well, maybe try this or maybe try that. I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll try that. So in some ways it was kind of liberating to not have as much sense that I had to control everything as a writer. And yet at the same time, I'm kind of grateful that as the person who lived that whole experience, I still was there and very much part of the process to be able to say, like, actually, no, I don't want this. I don't agree with that suggestion because I don't think it's realistic enough in terms of how a survivor would act or what trauma does to people. So in some ways I was thinking, you know, it's so much more of a collaborative process writing a screenplay than writing a novel that, sure, I was grateful to have something like a producer or something like a script editor who was like kind of giving me direction and I would just kind of like follow their suggestions. And yeah, I could also still think as a kind of survivor and activist in terms of really advocating for that survivor's point of view to be authentic. But I think it was interesting to have a script editor suggest like, well, let's do this and maybe like, I don't really know if that's gonna work, but like, whatever you guys are paying me, so let's try it, right? And then also for us to be like, no, that didn't really work, so, or we'll scale it back, or, so it's been an interesting process to have to, I mean, you know, I've done 3 drafts of it, and the second draft went in a really different direction, and then we scaled it, we changed it back with a 3rd draft, which I think a lot of the screenwriters like find to be part of the process, but that whole sort of chopping and changing doesn't quite happen with novels, and it would, if it happened with novels, it'd just be like so much more work, whereas with screenplay, because it's not as much actual writing, you know, you can be more flexible like that. But for me, it was, yeah, quite liberating to not have that sort of, not be as emotionally tied to whatever was happening on the page in the same way, because I'd already gotten that out of my system with the novel.
Mm. So it sounds a bit like when you were writing the screenplay, you were wearing all of the different hats that you've worn throughout life. You know, you're a little bit of the producer idea, you know, mind, and then you also had your writer mind, and then your activist side as well. So a lot of different things were at play for you there. And then kind of your second novel, Complicit, which is, you know, set within the world of the film industry, and it tackles very head on the Me Too movement from inside the storm, inside the eye of the storm, so to speak. What was it like writing this novel with your film background? You know, did you have colleagues reaching out to you once it then came out, worried that maybe they had been represented in it? Because, you know, not many characters are portrayed in a very flattering light. So, you know, what was that process and the aftermath once it came out?
So I didn't have that many ex-colleagues reaching out to me about, you know, were they portrayed or were they kind of the inspiration for different characters? I think because, you know, there was such a big break between my film producing career, the trauma happened, and then, you know, and then all over a decade, right? Before Complicit came out, well over a decade. And so I think for me, there was just a pretty marked break between the people I was in touch with then and the people that I'm, the circles I move in now. I have come across a lot of film people who have read it and enjoyed it, and they're like, yeah, it's very realistic. So I think for me, in terms of what I was trying to do with that novel, aside from, you know, the obvious thing would be, you know, addressing Me Too, but it was kind of to try to relive my days partly, as a young 20-something woman of color working in the film industry, who, you know, loved film and had, you know, and wanted to kind of soak up everything there was to learn about filmmaking and this craft, this magic of creating what we see on screens. And also just sort of confronting the reality of kind of the inequality of that entire industry. sort of the rampant classism and sexism, and I suppose kind of embedded racism in that industry, and just how difficult it would be for anybody, if you didn't have the right connections, if you didn't already come from certain circles, to establish a successful and satisfying career in film. Because I don't think there's that many people that have satisfying careers in film, or maybe they tell themselves that it is, or maybe it's financially satisfying, but it's not artistically satisfying, or it's neither artistically or financially satisfying. And I mean, I guess obviously it depends on what role you're playing within the industry, but it's an industry that kind of attracts so many people because of the mythology it creates about itself. And because of this glamour, and it is obviously there are very glamorous aspects to the film industry, but for anybody that's a working professional, there's very unglamorous aspects to it too. We just don't really see that side of it until we're in it. So I kind of want to look at sort of this supposed glamour that attracts so many people and almost kind of dupes a lot of young people into thinking like, oh, I can move to LA and become a star, or I can, you know, work really hard and be really talented and have that career, because I didn't think that it was actually that fair, right? I don't necessarily think it was the most talented, the most hardworking people that got to have careers, right? It was a lot of it was about who you knew or how good you were at networking or how much money you could access in certain ways. And I still find that today in terms of, you know, like how do these films get made? And then in the meantime, you find like gems of screenplays that don't get produced, or you find incredibly talented filmmakers who maybe make one feature and then they can't somehow manage to have a second feature made. Most of these are women, right? You know, so mm-hmm. It's kind of like, it's kind of quite shocking, because you can't say it's necessarily these people aren't talented enough. Obviously, if they've proven their worth in one feature film, then, you know, they should be able to make a second feature film. But the whole process by which you get to make a film is so fraught and so challenging, and it often doesn't really make any sense, that it's really quite sad if you think about all the talent that never gets realized, or all the screenplays that never get made, or all the fantastic films that could have been films, where producers and screenwriters and directors and actors have put in all this effort to get the film to a certain point, but then they never manage to actually shoot it and, you know, turn it into a film that people can see. So, yeah, I kind of want to show that side of things. And I think for your average person who doesn't work in film, like they're not really aware of that entire process and how fraught it is, how much passion goes into it, how much hard work, and how often that is not rewarding financially, yeah. Or
how much heartbreak.
The heartbreak of the industry.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah. And you know, you mentioned how it's mostly women who don't really see, you know, a lot of female directors don't get the funding, and that's reflected in the ratio of male to female directors who have films produced and subsequently who also win awards. And do you think Me Too, the movement Me Too, has somehow helped to level the playing field in this hierarchical industry? Or I know that it's not directly about male to female ratio, or, you know, people of color being more represented within the film industry, but it's definitely about power imbalance, and they're all instances of power imbalance. So do you think Me Too has helped to open out the playing field a little bit within the film industry?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, a little bit. It's certainly not, it's not 50-50, it's not level, but it certainly helped. I mean, I think since Me Too, and also, you know, there was like hashtag Oscars so white, there was kind of a number of different movements that were happening, primarily started in LA, which then kind of filtered out, which were conversations about inclusivity, or lack of diversity, right? Whether that's gender diversity, I suppose, or also racial diversity. So that has led, I mean, if you were to compare the amount of, you know, I guess sort of award nominated or award winning films by women now versus like 10 years ago, I think that I would hope that would have changed. I mean, certainly we've had a woman director winning best director most recently, or, you know, or if I look at kind of the British independent film, I'm based in London, so I'm going to kind of automatically have kind of British
in your mind,
films,
yeah,
in front of me. Yeah. So if you look at that, like you will if you look at those films, you will see more kind of female directed films that are kind of included among those nominated. But then you do see some pretty dire statistics still in terms of how, despite all that, it's still something like 10%. It depends on which films you're measuring, but it's still a very, very kind of insignificant figure of women directed films that make it and get released. So that is changing, and it is certainly, for me, it's noticeable. And you're seeing that in the content as well. You know, you have, I mean, specifically thinking about issues of sexual assault, I mean, you had some great series like I May Destroy You or Unbelievable, which came out kind of in the wake of Me Too, which were, you know, we're looking at those issues, but I think in very authentic, very survivor-centered ways. I don't think those would have been made prior to Me Too. And in terms of that larger conversation about diversity, yeah, of course. I mean, again, if you look at Netflix casting, like they are definitely making an effort for more diverse casting. And you're seeing that in the UK as well. And I'd like to think in Ireland too. So yeah, that there is change, but it's still pretty slow. And it's still like, you know, a few years of that change versus like a century of a very, very male dominated industry. And I'd be curious to see how the money plays out as well in terms of like how it's great that women are getting more visibility and getting more prominence, but how are they being paid? Are they being paid on a...
That's the next conversation that we need to be having, really, you know, open conversations about money and, you know, how it's spread out amongst different genders and different people, you know, people of different nationalities and ethnicities across the industry, because that will be a huge eye opener, I am sure. And then, you know, just talking more about casting, obviously you haven't adapted Complicit for screen, but if you were to, and, you know, in a fantasy world, the writer had some say over the casting process, which we know is not true in real life, who would you cast in your main roles in Complicit if you, you know, just think of it like fantasy soccer or fantasy football, sort of, you're creating a fantasy football team. Who would you put in the roles of your main characters in Complicit?
Well, I mean, it's tough because so Complicit's main character is Sarah Lai, who is Chinese American, right? So there's not that many Chinese American women or Chinese diaspora women in the West who are, I guess, considered people that would unlock financing, so to speak, in a producer sense, right? So on one hand, like I could say obvious names, but then at the same time, you also, is that even equitable, right? In some ways, right? Because you know, as a former actor, I know as a producer, there's loads of amazing actors out there whose talent hasn't been recognized, right? So is it fair to just be naming like the obvious names just because they've reached that level of visibility? I mean, I was very impressed with Stephanie Hsu's work in what is that film? Everything Everywhere. Mm-hmm. All at once, right?
Yeah, Everything Everywhere All at Once. Yeah.
Did I say that correctly? Yes.
Yeah, I think that's
so
it.
So she played. Yeah, so she was the daughter in Michelle Yeoh's character, and I thought she was fantastic. You've since seen her in a few other things. I mean, Hollywood's definitely having, I'm a little bit jealous of somebody who lives on this side of the Atlantic, but in LA, there's definitely all this stuff I see on Instagram in terms of Asian American kind of solidarity. There's all these sorts of movements in terms of, you know, getting Asian Americans like more visibility. So you have Simo Liu, you have, you know, I mean, sorry, I'm totally blanking on names. Anyway, cut that out. So in Hollywood, especially, you're getting a sense of all this kind of increasing visibility and solidarity for Asian Americans, which hasn't quite happened here on this side of the Atlantic in terms of kind of industry presence or visibility. So, yeah, I know there's definitely kind of a, I guess, hunger for Asian American led projects. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, Complicit hasn't been optioned yet. I mean, I had a few exciting meetings with people out in LA who said they were really excited, and then I never heard from them again, which is what
familiar.
Happens, right? Yeah, exactly. So who
Did
knows?
Did you mention the film industry?
Yeah, it's like, oh, we're so excited. Yeah. Never hear from them again. Yeah. Great. But even that, like that level of ghosting, which is part and parcel of the industry.
My producer ghosted me is your next podcast, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, which is part and parcel of the industry. It's like the level, the amount of kind of emotional toughening up you have to be like, oh, you know, that just happens in the industry. So this kind of sort of false like excitement coupled with the actual reality of never hearing from people again.
Absolutely. I remember one of my agents back when I was an actor full time said to me, you know, oh, you know, you've been penciled for this job. But, you know, we write it in pencil because until you're there on the day, on the set, it doesn't exist. It's like, okay, right. So that was my first understanding of that whole aspect. And I've experienced it so many ways as a writer and screenwriter and all those things, you know, things that you think are a shoo-in are definitely going to happen. Yeah. And they just don't happen. But actually, speaking of your next projects, you have something else in the pipeline that you're writing. Can you tell us a bit about that? please.
Yeah, sure. So we've got less than 2 minutes left. Do you want to start a new call, or I guess, or should I say as much? I'll say as much as I can, and then are there more questions after? Okay.
No, I think it's nice to be short and sweet.
So my next novel comes out in 2025, and that's kind of a road trip story about three estranged adult siblings that are kind of forced to go on a road trip together across America to see their ailing mother in California. The additional layer to it is that they're all Asian, they're Chinese American, and so they're driving across parts of America, Trump territory, I suppose, which may not be the friendliest towards Chinese Americans in the wake of COVID. So I kind of wanted to look at those different layers of, you know, what does it mean to be American? And, you know, we have this whole fascination with a road trip from an American perspective, but is that kind of sense of adventure and freedom really only available to certain people, to white men or to white people, right? And the kinds of dangers that maybe we feel, or the anxieties we have as people of color or as women traveling into unknown territories. So I wanted to look at that, but then also look at, you know, what happens to families when siblings grow apart and they vote in different ways and they grow apart politically and also financially.
That sounds like it would make an amazing film.
I'd like to think. Yeah. So we'll see.